Accession number 27767, reel 11.
Adrian Holloway, reel 11. So, we left you in Tanganyika, in Tanga.
Yes. We were then based on Mombasa, or rather, as they call it, Kilindini, and made several sweeps into the Indian Ocean, and as I said before, hoped that we didn't meet the Japanese, who were far more superior force to us.
What did you feel about the Japanese at the time? You respected their ability, did you?
Let's face it, we feared them. I mean, after all, they'd had a terrible reputation. News of their bestialities was getting through, and that to be taken prisoner is not an enviable thought at all, but to be taken prisoner by the Japanese would be sheer and utter hell, and we didn't know how much hell until after the war. So they commanded the whole of the Indian Ocean, right from Ceylon to back up to the Aleutian Islands in the Pacific. And there was nothing that could stop them at the time, nothing at all. So with our pitiful old force, which was old, we really would have been mincemeat, which was very unfortunate. In fact, later on we ventured to Ceylon, and we were based in Trincomalee, which at that time we were the only HM ship there. Trincomalee was known as the Scarpa Flow of the East. There were no facilities whatsoever, and the commander made a very encouraging broadcast saying that there's nothing now between us and the Japanese, which didn't really help. I can't remember why we were detached to do that, but later on we started to escort convoys from Bombay to Fremantle. We used to collect two large ships which contained American and Australian / New Zealand troops, and take them to Bombay in order for them to be put into the Burma front. On one of these occasions, I, as ASDIC officer, had an unfortunate occurrence. We were alone on our way to Fremantle, and suddenly there was a jarring of the ship, and I was sent for by the captain. And what had happened was that a whale had spouted just ahead of us. The officer of the watch had, of course, seen it, but you can't turn a big cruiser very quickly. And he hit the poor beast. Well, of course, there was a lot of blood around and so on. But the whale, who I'm afraid died, had done great damage to our ASDIC or sonar dome, which was at that time below the hull of the ship, pinging away for submarines. Water was coming in, but we eventually managed to stabilize that. And so it was quite obvious that we were no longer any use as a fighting unit. So we turned back and went into Bombay, and we were there for Christmas 1943. Shall I put how I like Bombay?
Yes. So what was Bombay like at Christmas then?
Well, I have never liked Christmases away from home, but it was really rather stupid and typical of the Navy, I thought, that we were served, I think it was roast pork and Christmas pudding, when the sweat was practically streaming down our faces. But Bombay, at that time, I liked very much. We, of course, the Raj was still at its height, and we were invited to a ball at Government House. which was delightful, except that there were the men far outnumbered the girls by about 5 to 1. There was a delightful place called the Willingdon Club, which had been started by Lord Willingdon, one of our past viceroys of India. And this was unusual in that it allowed Indians as members also. Now, there were a lot of Indians who had titles. They'd been knighted by the king, and one rejoiced in the name of Sir Jamset Gigi Boy, which I thought was a lovely name. And I read that off the board in my astonishment, and one of the servants said, "Do you wish to see Sir Jamset, Gene?" I said hurriedly, no, I don't. But it was a delightful place, and we were able to relax there. The favourite game was to place 4 silver ashtrays onto a diving board, and then you'd do a dive off the board, and you had to catch the ashtrays before they reached the bottom, which was quite fun. We also went up to Pune, which was about 70 miles away. We went up by train. And I'd always heard, of course, that this was the ultimate of the army in India, that you talked about being a Pune colonel and so on. Actually, we hardly ever saw a soldier at all. I think that most of them were out at a place called Kirki. But what was interesting was that we walked around the walls of the prison, and inside was Mr. Gandhi, who had been one of his incarcerations because he'd been stirring up trouble. And, of course, that in wartime was very unhelpful indeed.
Were you aware of Mr. Gandhi and the movement that was going on in India then?
Oh, yes, we were. And also, there was a movement led by Subhas Chandra Bose, who, of course, was an Indian, and he was the leader of the Indian Nationalist Movement. I'm not sure where he was based, but I think among the Japanese. And he was getting, or trying to get, Indian troops to fight for the Japanese. And I think he was fairly successful in some respects. On the other hand, there were many Indian regiments who fought most gallantly for the British. So that was Gandhi, and we also had on board another Gandhi, without the H, and who was one of my midshipmen in the gun room, and he was Royal Indian Navy, as it was then, and he was a charming chap, very, very nice indeed. But when we were in South Africa, he never went ashore because of the colour bar. So the poor fellow stayed on board all the time. And he later on became Commander-in-Chief of the Indian Navy, so I felt that I had something to do with his training.
And was he trained in the same way as you? Did you get
absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So our time in... I went down to inspect the Aztec Dome in the dry dock, and it was absolutely crumpled, as though about 20... 10-ton buses had bumped into it, completely crumpled, and of course was quite useless and had to be renewed. And it's something really that a whale should have done more damage to us than the Japanese ever did.
How many times had you been down to Fremantle and back? Quite a few.
We did about 3 trips to Fremantle, and one of the occasions was really, in a sense, rather amusing, but in a sense it was also rather horrific. One of the big ships contained American troops. One of the big ships contained New Zealand troops. And we were between the two, anchored at Fremantle. Leave was given to the Americans on one night and leave to the New Zealanders on another night. Now, I was officer of the watch when the Americans were ashore. And I suddenly saw, in the gloom, the New Zealanders climbing down the hawsers and so on, with knives in their teeth, and getting ashore. And the rumour had gone round the New Zealanders that the Americans had behaved very badly when they went through New Zealand on the way to Bombay, and that they'd been having fun and games with their wives and girlfriends. Whether this was true or not, one doesn't know. But anyway, there was pitched fighting in the streets of sort of Fremantle. And, of course, that was not a very good thing, since one wanted them to fight the Japanese and not themselves.
They were being taken out for the Burma front.
That's right. Those trips I liked very much indeed, because you got out of the humidity of the Indian Ocean. Fremantle was a funny little port then. I believe it's much bigger now, but always rather suburban compared to its far bigger sister, Perth. The Western Australians used to say, "Ah, poor little WA, we're about 2 years behind the rest of Australia." And I think at that time it was true, because air travel was in its infancy across America, across Australia. There was no transcontinental railway as there is now, and people used to say that the women were sort of 2 years behind in the fashions and all that sort of thing. So. But we bathed there and went out to picnics and so on. And in the limited time that we were there, we had a grand time. Great fun. We never met any enemy, fortunately, deposited all the troops back in Bombay quite all right. So that was really the thing. Then we started to be based in Ceylon, in Colombo. That was very enjoyable too. Colombo at that time was a nice capital, quite clean, and we would go out to a place called Mount Lavinia, which had lovely surfing, and again we enjoyed ourselves very much. But we were not able to go inland, so there wasn't that much to do. There was also a lovely hotel called the called the Goreface, where you could have a very good meal in the most lovely touristy surroundings. I remember bathing in Colombo Harbour, and the temperature of the water was something like 80 degrees, so it wasn't very refreshing.
Were you used to hearing what was going on with the Japanese and the Americans and so on at this stage?
Oh, yes.
Or following all this, were you?
Yes. But there was one time when we could get the BBC just. There was one time when this was the most extraordinary thing. At that time, the BBC had men announcers, there weren't any women, and so we were at sea for about 8 weeks, and you never heard a woman's voice. Now that had a very peculiar effect on everybody. I mean, it was very frustrating in a sense, and not a thing to be recommended.
So they kept you away from, there were no wrens about all.
Oh no, no, but there like were wren, there were wrens in Colombo. And I met and took out a wren who had lived in Nailsworth, only 2 miles from here. So that was rather nice. I don't think there's really anything very much more. It sounds dull, but, you know, it was just sort of patrolling and this, that and the other. Oh, yes, when we were in Trincomalee, by that time, Trincomalee had filled up. This was 1944. And there were battleships there and an aircraft carrier, and my old ship Valiant, which had been repaired and brought out, together with Queen Elizabeth. And it was January the 10th, 1944, and my 21st birthday. And there was nothing much you could do, really, but several people in the gun room threw thunder flashes, which were little tiny sort of miniature bombs which would explode with a very loud noise. And this was supposed to celebrate my birthday, but it had more of an effect than that because searchlights focused on us. They thought the Japanese had arrived. But it was merely Holloway's birthday. I think that's all really in the notion. And
right.
I think what I can do now is to... during the time that I was in the Indian Ocean, I became friends with the fighter direction officer, Lieutenant Commander Stobart, and spent quite a time in our air direction room. Now, this was something that had been very much perfected by the Americans in the Pacific, in that originally nobody had directed aircraft as they had had been done by the RAF in the Battle of Britain. There, of course, they had underground direction stations and large supporting radar stations, and were able to direct the fighters onto the enemy, thus saving fuel and getting them to the right place at the right time. So this was taken on by the Navy, and it was entirely new, and I thought that this was something I could do. I would like to have been a pilot, but they wouldn't let RN officers be pilots during the war for the rather frightful reason that they considered the RNVR more expendable. So I thought I'd do the next best thing, and that is to direct fighters by aircraft, by radar. So I applied to become a fighter director, and I was interviewed by the Fleet Fighter Direction Officer in the Far East, who was none other than Lieutenant Commander the Viscount St. Vincent, a direct descendant of the great admiral of the 18th century. And I was duly accepted, and then had to wait passage home. So I left the cruiser Suffolk when my relief arrived, and I suppose that was about August 1944. And I and several others awaiting passage home were accommodated in a transit camp which was on the outskirts of Colombo. It was very pleasant, and the food was good, and there I acquired a taste for curry, which I've always kept ever since. We went... Oh, I'm sorry, would you mind? It may be the... What did I say? Oh, yes, we were...
You were in a transit camp.
That's right.
Eating curry.
Yes. We were then told that we were to take passage home in the aircraft carrier Raja, which was possibly appropriate since we were in Indian territory. This was commanded by Captain Caspar John, who was the son of the painter Augustus John. And the first flag officer, he subsequently became an admiral, to have wings on his arm. He'd become a pilot.
What sort of a chap was he?
Well, to be honest, I hardly saw him at all. We were just there, and I didn't keep watch or anything, so I don't know what he was like. I'm told they had a pretty bohemian upbringing. All the children used to go around naked, and they lived a very bohemian life.
You never saw any signs of that, though.
No, no. Oh, no, he was very circumspect. We arrived without any trouble in Greenock. I suppose in September 1944, and it was wonderful to be home again after having been away for about another 18 months. One continually saw how Britain had changed during that time, and I felt rather like Rip Van Winkle. There were many more women in uniform. Shortages were everywhere. There were expressions like being browned off, which I'd never heard before. Of course, radio programs and so on, all of which were utterly strange to me. And some people, as I say, were using expressions which were not familiar at all. And then I took my cousin to a theatre in London, and we heard a crunch, and that was one of the first V2 rockets. So I was very glad I wasn't near it.
Did it seem to you, coming back, that the people in England and the UK were having a harder time than you'd realised?
Oh, yes, I think that's true. I think some people were very short of food, although the rationing was extremely well done, and it's always been said that Britain was never better fed or never more healthily fed than in the war. That Lord Walton did the most wonderful job. But I think I've said before, my mother kept hens, and she'd done some good hoarding, so with the aid of some extra ration books, we certainly didn't starve. But, of course, having been abroad, we'd always been well fed, and to find yourself rationed again was a bit of a unpleasant experience. The thing I particularly remember were the what we call the British restaurants, where you... no meal was allowed to cost more than 5 shillings. And at that time, 5 shillings was quite a sum anyway, but you see, what was extraordinary was that you had to... you didn't have to give up your ration cards if you had a meal at a restaurant. And later on, when I recount my going back to the Pacific, this will be in evidence once more. So I then joined the fighter direction course, and our first week was down at Portsmouth, where we were given an intensive course in learning about radar. Well, I had been dealing with radar for a long time, and so it's no boast to say that a lot of it was nothing new to me. But we learnt the insides of what the sets could do, and quite rightly what it could not do, and so we knew its capabilities when we came to using it. We then, all of us, took train to Yeovil, and there were 36 of us started the course, and at the end, in March 1945, only 12 were left who'd qualified, and dare I say it, I came top.
Well, why did so many people drop out? That seems quite a high rate.
The answer is that it was what they would call today a steep learning curve. They weren't going to bother with training people who weren't going to make the grade. And they were all out ruthlessly. One day they were there, the next day they were not. And so, as I say, you know, 24 disappeared without trace. Mm. It just left, and that was that.
Yeah. So what sort of elements were in this course? You did radar.
Yes. Well, then we were accommodated at a delightfully small aerodrome called Charlton Hawthorne, which was not far from the very big naval air station of Yeovilton.
Sorry, Charlton?
Charlton Hawthorne, H-O-R-E-T-H-O-R-N-E. And We lived in the mess there with the pilots of 790 Squadron, who were the ones who we were going to direct by radar, which so you got to know them and their voices and everything else. It was a very sensible arrangement. And I remember that our quarters were about half a mile or more from the mess, and I was bicycling. I borrowed a bicycle. I was bicycling back to the mess one day, and a fighter plane came in with its wheels down, and I only just managed to throw myself into a ditch and didn't get decapitated by the wheels. We were there for about a month, and every day we would go down to what was called Speckington Manor, which was a large house which had been taken over by the Navy and fully equipped. We learnt how to direct the fighters by using what had been formerly ice cream vendors' machines, and these had been used before the war on the promenades of places like Southsea and Bournemouth and so on, the forefront of the conveyance would have a large refrigerated compartment in it from which he would sell ice cream. Well, and he would peddle it along ringing his bell. Well, these were commandeered by the Navy, and they made ideal targets and fighters, because some boards would be put where the ice cream had been, so that you had a limited vision, and you then had headphones on, which connected you to the fighter controller. You were probably the fighter, and the Wrens would be the target, and you had a metronome in front of you, which you would set according to the speeds that you were told to pedal at. So you would pedal according to the metronome going backwards and forwards. It was frightfully simple, but extremely clever, and cost nobody anything except just converting the ice cream machines. And that's how we learned to fire control aircraft. What was rather extraordinary was that several times I heard music in my earphones instead of the orders of the fighter controller.